We spent some time in the first half of this orientation session thinking about research and some of the regulations related to reappointment and renewal and tenure and promotion. And the principal and I started by saying we'd like to think of McGill as a place where research and teaching go together. And so what we're going to move into this afternoon are some other of the concerns that we have, and one of the most important ones is that we help you to launch your teaching careers in an effective and efficient way. It's very important to see that connection between what you're doing your research on and how you interact with students at both the undergraduate and graduate level. So focusing on the teaching mission of the university, the student-centeredness is really important. So Cynthia is going to walk us through. There are some interaction that we're going to take where you're going to have to answer questions, even if you won't ask them. You'll have to answer them by using a device that's now used in many classrooms in order to help pedagogically help professors understand and gear their presentations to what people tell them they've understood from those presentations. So Cynthia will walk us through that. Cynthia Weston is a professor of educational and counseling psychology and is the founding director of our Teaching and Learning Services, which came out of something called the Center for University Teaching and Learning. So it's a great pleasure to work with Cynthia and to have her here to make this presentation and get some feedback from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Provost, for that kind introduction. And it's wonderful. Bonjour tout le monde. Wonderful to see you here today and welcome you to, well, we're about to find out how long you've been here. And in fact, let's start with getting to know a little bit about you. You've gotten to know a little bit about us. I don't know if you've used these clickers before, but push the number that corresponds to the faculty that you are in. For those of you who haven't used this before, you can see the responses going up in the upper right-hand corner. We've got 43, 4. I don't know exactly how many people we have here. 47, 8, 9. All right. Final answer. We're going to close the polls now. So, oh, perfect. That is not supposed to happen. That is not supposed to happen. Ah! Qu'est-ce qui se passe?
Just try to restart it.
This?
Yeah.
Is that the one?
There's something it did not like.
Something it did not like. Maybe it's the Mac slides that are in it that I had to add.
I'm not sure.
Here we are. Let's just try it again. You're going to have to push again.
Oh, you can just go to the next slide then, I guess.
No, I don't want to. Okay, can we open the polls?
Yeah, we'll just...
So, yes.
You want to
open
the polls?
Early and often, but in the system, only your last vote counts.
I think it may be because we integrated some Mac slides into it, and I think it... No, and it would have gone the other way if it was Mac and we integrated PC slides. I think it's just because it doesn't.
While we're waiting, how did you take advantage of the laptop offer?
That's not good. Huh? I do not. No, that's okay. Because the actual version you have doesn't have this in it. It doesn't have the program in it to run the clickers.
Do you want to go ahead with the second slide?
No, let's start with this one. You don't think we should do that one again?
Yeah, sure.
It's meant to help you both get your teaching and your research up to speed. So
open?
Now we're going to actually let you vote again.
Yeah, well, for some reason. Of course, this is a good lesson, by the way, for using technology in teaching. You always have to have a secondary plan, which we're going to go to in about 2 seconds. It's not opening.
It's something, the Turning Point plugin crashed.
So it's not going to work?
No.
Oh, no. Or what, do you think it's because of the Mac slides?
I'm not sure what it is, but I tested them before. They were working, and now they're not. So you'll have to go to this one.
Oh, yeah. That's okay. We're just going to do it without the voting.
Yeah.
So it seems that our program has crashed. So we're going to do this in the old-fashioned way. How many of you are from agriculture? One agriculture. Two. Arts. We got a few from arts. Education. A few from education. Engineering. Okay. Law. Nobody here from law. Management. A couple from management. Medicine and dentistry. Welcome. Music. Not music. Religious studies. And science. So we have a good range. There are two faculties that aren't represented in this moment. But we've hired how many this year, Provost? 70-something. So we have a good representation, because I think just before it crashed, there were about 50 of you who responded. How much teaching experience? Now, see, these are the ones. This is one reason why clickers are really good, because then you get to be anonymous. And it's a little harder to be anonymous when you have to raise your hands. So you can choose to participate or not in this, since we're going to do it face-to-face. How many of you have more than 6 years of teaching experience? We're starting at the bottom. Okay, so a number of you have been teaching for more than 6 years. 3 to 6 years. Okay. 1 to 2. All right. 1 or 2 courses, maybe not 1 or 2 years. All right. TA only. And a few? None? Okay. Welcome. No, I mean, we have a range of teaching experience, and that's why we have support services for all levels of teaching experience. And thank you for letting us know that, so we should talk after. Now, this one is going to be a hard one. How confident do you feel about your teaching skills? Well, I can tell you, when I started 30 years ago here at McGill, I was definitely number 4. And I was just talking to one of my colleagues here. In fact, I see other nods here from my colleagues who've been here for a number of years. I would say a lot of us were about number 4. I hadn't really taught before I came here. And, facing a group of students and you're wondering what questions they'll ask and how you're going to manage, I was a little freaked out. Does anybody else feel a little freaked out? Not so well. All right. I was with you. A little nervous. A little nervous about it, feeling kind of okay. And some are feeling kind of confident. You know, some of you have had quite a bit of teaching experience, so you're feeling kind of confident about it. Well, there is a range of how people feel, and I can tell you a lot of people who are up in front of the classroom are extremely nervous, and that's just part of the territory. We've got all kinds of services where we can work with individual consultations and workshops where you're with other professors or you're on your own, so we've got all different levels of support for you. Are different kinds of teaching strategies. So just take a minute and in your own head, take a look at this and think about what are the top 2 ways that you tend or intend to teach. And I can pretty much tell you, having done this particular slide before in new faculty orientations, we get a pretty good range of responses to this. I won't ask you to respond individually to this one. There are a range of teaching strategies, and I'm sure you've experienced them. And for those of you who've had teaching experience, you've used them. Some of these may be more familiar to you than others. But there are a range of teaching experiences, teaching methods to use. What's really important is that you be intentional about it and that we use this range of teaching methods to achieve the goals that we're trying to achieve at McGill. So I want to share with you and go back to what the provost introduced and the principal introduced us to at the beginning, which is the notion of a student-centered university, which doesn't just mean that you care about students, because I think we all care about students, but it really means we're talking about learning and academic development. Another important role for us is mentoring students and helping them in their personal development, and we'll hear more about that later today from the Dean of Students. And general campus life. So student-centeredness at McGill really involves all aspects of student experience while they are on campus, and it's part of our role as professors. Our goals for teaching are many, but these are some of our major goals that I'd like you to think about, and I'd like you to think about them in terms of those teaching methods that you just thought about for yourself. Let's just walk through these. That at McGill, we want a stimulating intellectual and creative environment that is challenging for students, because we know challenge helps student learning and development. We want an active and collaborative learning environment where they're actively involved in learning either by themselves or with others, because we know, again, that these are precursors for student learning and student success. Student-faculty interaction is a very important predictor of student success at university, and so that interaction, those opportunities to interact in class through clickers, a lot of profs in large classes use clickers, is very important for student development and student success at the university. And a lot of it happens outside the classroom as well. Those little moments when you have conversations, very important for students, particularly in their first years. Enriching educational experiences. You'll probably be hearing a bit more about this later on today, but it's important that students have complementary experiences to what's happening academically as well. And that's one of the things we've really been working on at McGill. Are you talking about a co-curricular transcript? Because that's something that's coming forward, is ways that students can actually document some of the leadership activities that they're engaged in at the university. And supportive campus environment. Again, this is a really important predictor of success. If students feel that the institution is committed to their success, they tend to be more successful in their learning and in their development. So think about these in terms of how you're going to bring these about in your teaching. How can you ensure the level of challenge, that it's active and collaborative for the learners, that you're interacting, that you're giving lots of opportunities for interaction. So it's that notion of being intentional with the methods that you're using. Two things. You've had a lot of information today. Two things I want you to remember, and this is the first one. There are teaching support services at McGill. We have a wide range of them, and they are here to help you. You probably received in your mailbox today, you should have received today, it came out for the first time this morning, a Focus on Teaching bulletin, which is a listing of all of the activities, workshops, events that are here to support your teaching and are being offered. So take a look at it. I know you got a lot of email, but if there are things you're interested in teaching, open that one and keep an eye out for it as it comes. We have a website, McGill.ca, TLS, standing for Teaching and Learning Services, /teaching. That's the one you want to keep in mind, because if you go there, you will find pulled in one place almost everything that you need to know about teaching at McGill. These are some of the ones I'm just going to go through with you. I want to introduce you to the website and show you what's there so that you know to go and look yourself. All the policies and guidelines related to teaching, course evaluations, workshops, seminars, and events, which are also in your Focus on Teaching, consultations, and teaching snapshots. And let's just take a look at a couple of these. So you'll see here on the website, Teaching at McGill, down the left-hand side are all of these headers that I've just talked to you about. And there are a couple that I want to draw your attention to, not to remember all the details, but to know where to find them. Right here, you'll see there is a course outline brief guide. For those of you who haven't created a course outline before at McGill, if you go to this site, you will find all the headings that you need to have and how you set up your course outline. I think you'll find that particularly useful. There's a course evaluations. You may or may not know, for those of you who are newer to McGill, that all courses at McGill with 5 students or more must be evaluated. So if you go to this site, you will see the policy and the background, how you can go about interpreting the results that you get. Mercury is the name of our online course evaluation system. All students respond online, and you as professors can choose to give permission to access the numerical aspect of your course evaluations. I wanted to show you here Mercury online manuals. So this is as the student, how do I view my course evaluation results? But there's a whole section here for you, the instructor. How do I access the Mercury for the instructor? Oops, I just clicked on the wrong thing, my mistake, sorry. Where did I just, there it is. How do I access, how do I preview or print my course evaluations? How do I download them? How do I download TA reports? Lydia was talking to you about your tenure and promotion files. These are the kinds of things that you will be including in your tenure and promotion files, so it's good to know that it's there. So we'll go back to, I wanted to show you as well that I want you to know about the consultations. We do have individual consultations and unit consultations, and Susan Cowan, who is sitting over here, wave your hand, Susan, does individual consultations for professors on any aspect of teaching that you might be interested in. They are totally confidential. And finally, I want to show you what are called teaching snapshots. This is actually a new site at McGill. And what you will see here, you see this little thing under here says teaching snapshots. What we've been doing is interviewing a lot of professors at McGill about their perspectives on teaching. We have about 20 professors from almost every different faculty. So you can go and look for professors in your faculty, and we can click on any one of them. Let's look at George McCourt. And what you'll see is each of them responded to 7 questions. So these might be of interest to you in getting some ideas about how other people in your faculty are teaching. What are some of the strategies they use? How do they evaluate student learning? What's the most important thing students in your discipline should learn? So for each of these, you can just click on it and see what that particular person had to say. I think you'll find it very useful. They have also put their email address is included in each one of these. They have asked specifically that you reach out to them, contact them, ask them questions if you have any questions about teaching, in addition to speaking with us. One more thing I want to show to you, which will get me back to, I'm going to have to go back here to TLS and teaching. Is the teaching portfolio. The teaching portfolio is one of the things that you include in your tenure and promotion dossier. There are some changes coming up on that, so look for that in the focus on teaching. But I want you to be aware that there are consultations again on creating a teaching portfolio. There are samples here that are available. The most, and this is the second thing to remember, and Lydia said something about it earlier today, keep a virtual or a real shoebox. I'm not kidding. It's so hard to go back and find this information when you're putting together your reappointment dossier at 3 years or your tenure dossier at 6 years or your appointment to full professor. Keep track of all the courses that you teach, the invitations that you get, the students that you're supervising. It seems like you'll remember them all, but it's really hard to retrace all of that. So keep a virtual shoebox for all of those contributions that you're making. So finally, and you've heard this today, don't hesitate to ask. IT services, teaching and learning services. If you're standing in your classroom and your program crashes, as mine did today, in most classrooms, and it's not here, there is a phone that you can pick up. And it says, help desk. You can push that button, and they will remotely take over your computer and help you to solve your problem. It's really important that you know to use that telephone in your classroom. If you're in your office and you're having a problem with any of your technology, you're working on preparing something using Turning Point or using our course management system, call 3398. That's the help desk. They will answer your questions. They will triage you and send you to the right location. And remember to look at our website, tls/teaching, for all the information about teaching, or you can call us at 6648. So there's lots of support here available for you, and we're looking forward to meeting with you. Are there any questions? Yeah. The university supports WebCT. That's our centrally supported system. So there are other ones available, but the university isn't centrally supporting it. That's why you're not finding information on it. You should know, however, that we are right now signing a contract with a new provider for a learning management system that I think you'll be very happy with. And that will be coming online in May of 2012, I believe. So stay tuned. Sorry? Yes, absolutely. We are going to be doing pilots. So give me your name and we're going to actually be getting together. I'm going to be leading some focus groups with professors and with students during this fall term, and I definitely want feedback from people. Absolutely. Give me your cards at the end, and I will be glad to do it. I want to show you also here under the workshops and events. This is a whole list of the workshops that are being offered this fall on using the learning management, using WebCT. But that's for WebCT at this point. Yes.
The laptop program offers maths as an option.
Sorry?
The academic laptop program offers maths as an option.
Yes.
But WebCT doesn't accept Safari as a browser. So this is kind of inconvenient.
Which one? Firefox.
I tried Firefox. It doesn't work either. Well, older versions of Firefox might, but not the newer ones.
Right. And there's a request form right here for IT, or you can call 3398. You can call 3398. That's a perfect kind of question to call them with, and they will walk you through that. If you have trouble remembering 3398, you know every phone number at McGill starts with 398. So 3398, just an easy one. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
I'm not sure if the right person to ask this question is, but this seems the most appropriate.
There. Right over to.
Yeah, we spent, last year we did two major surveys. One was the American Association of University Data Exchange survey of all academic staff members, and we did a survey with Coach from Harvard of just assistant professors on a tenure track. And the single most important thing that emerged from those surveys was that there isn't a formal mentorship program university-wide, but that professors, assistant professors, or those who came through the ranks prior to this year, who already have tenure, indicated they really wanted one or benefited from one and would like to make sure that we do it. So at the departmental level, you should be addressing that question to your chair, at the faculty level to your dean, and we're working with all the deans to institute, based on the feedback we got from very good response rates. Over 50% of the professors responded to a solicited questionnaire on this topic. So mentorship is a really important issue, providing you, and that's what today is in part about. How can we help you to be better at what you do? One of the mechanisms is having an informal or a formal mechanism of dealing with the system, how it has worked for others and how you can get through it more easily. It's not only a formal mentorship program, it's also informal that's considered to be valuable. So it's a good idea, and we're trying to implement one. So I thank you for asking. It's a good question.
So it's my pleasure to now introduce to you Professor Jane Everett, the Dean of Students, who will talk to you about McGill's expectations of students and support services for them.
Bonjour et bienvenue. Hello and welcome. Thank you for that introduction, Cynthia. I'm also a prof in the Department of French Language and Literature. What the Dean of Students does is a number of things. I won't bore you with everything involved there. I have a website, and if you really, really, really are curious, you can check it out. However, what I'm going to be speaking about today is expectations and support services with respect to students. You've received some material in what was handed out to you, or at least you should have, and I'd just like to draw your attention to it. One is our academic integrity resource for students. It's called Fair Play. It has scenarios illustrating areas in which students might have problems or have difficulty. It helps give you an idea of how we define things such as plagiarism and cheating here at McGill. I encourage you to take a look at it. You also have something we call the Red Folder, a very imaginative name for something that is primarily red, and I'll be getting back to this. You also have a copy of a letter that went out to deans and associate deans and instructors earlier in the year talking about what to do when you're worried about a student's behavior. Finally, you have a bookmark about the one official mentoring program that does exist at McGill, the staff student one, and I'll be talking about that very, very briefly. But I'd like to talk a little bit about our students. As you've been walking around campus, I think, the last couple of days, and particularly today, you've seen masses of new students arriving. So you're not the only new people here. There are many thousands of other new people here. They are some of the best undergraduate and graduate students in the world. And what do we expect of these people? In a way, some of the same things we expect of you. We want them to make their best efforts. We hope they will make their best efforts academically, and that they'll take advantage of the many academic opportunities that are offered to them, from the range of courses available to them to opportunities such as internships, study away, and so forth. We also expect them to educate themselves about things such as academic integrity and research ethics, and we give them the means to do so. We expect them to respect each other, to be tolerant of each other, and to be open to each other's difference
In other words, to treat them as respectfully and with respect of their human rights. We expect them as well, or we hope very much, that they will look beyond the academic bubble or the residence bubble, if they happen to be living in residence, to the larger McGill community, and that they will become involved in any way possible, or as many ways as possible, with McGill and the larger community through various activities, extracurricular among them. We expect them as well to accept their responsibility for understanding their program requirements and their graduation requirements, and to familiarize themselves with the various supports available to them so that they will seek advice, help, and support in a timely manner. So that's the theory, right? They have student rights and responsibilities. We all do as members of the McGill community. Those rights and responsibilities that students have are to some extent ours, and they overlap with ours, whether we're talking about human rights, academic rights, or procedural rights. And they're set out in a number of documents. I draw your attention in particular to this Charter of Student Rights. One article says that students are entitled to treatment without discrimination. Another article says they're entitled to fair evaluation. Another talks about the content of course syllabi. The Charter of Student Rights can be found on the Secretariat website that Lydia alluded to earlier, only not under /academic, but rather /students. You'll find there as well something called, in electronic version only now, however, I have one of the few remaining paper copies, which is usually kept under lock and key, is called the Handbook on Student Rights and Responsibilities. And it's a compendium that includes not only the Charter of Student Rights, but a number of policies affecting students, some of them as affecting staff as well, regarding the rights of students with disabilities, for instance, or the policy on the accommodation of religious holy days, protection from harassment, sexual harassment and discrimination, the policy regarding hazing and inappropriate initiation practices, conflicts of interests, and other policies which are of relevance to students in particular, as I say, or some which cover all members of the McGill community. This document, which can also be accessed, as I say, electronically on that website, the Secretariat website, contains a code of student conduct and disciplinary procedures. It contains, among other things, the McGill definitions for plagiarism and cheating, which may not necessarily correspond to the definitions you're familiar with in an academic environment. So I encourage you to take a look at that. Our responsibility as instructors is to ensure that students know what we mean by plagiarism and cheating, and that we give them the tools needed to avoid cheating and plagiarism so that they cannot claim ignorance. It means telling them about the citation software that the library makes available, or if they ask you questions about how to avoid plagiarism, that you're able to give them good answers. If you have questions yourselves on things such as that, or how to use copyright in PowerPoint presentations so that you're setting a good example and so forth, you can certainly contact the library or my office or colleagues in your department. Another way of helping students avoid plagiarism and cheating is to adopt methods of evaluation that do not encourage or facilitate cheating or plagiarism, and there the teaching and learning services can be of great help. The Handbook on Student Rights and Responsibilities in the Secretariat website also contains a code of student grievance procedures, so we have protections available to students when there's something going really, really wrong. But we try very much to use informal conflict resolution procedures before we get to the code of student grievance procedures. To that end, we have student affairs, associate deans of student affairs or directors of students advising who have similar positions who will help students sort out difficulties. There are undergraduate and graduate program directors within the departments who help in that way as well, as does my office and the Office of the Ombudsperson for Students. So what can go wrong with an undergraduate student or a graduate student? For many of them, it's their first experience of real academic challenge. They've always been the first in class. Suddenly they're in a group where everybody has been the first person in class. Now, statistically, and I'm not good in statistics, my area is literature, but I do know that means it's very unlikely that everyone's going to be first in the class if there's more than one person. I do understand that. And this sometimes that can be a very unsettling experience for the students, whether they're undergraduates or graduates. For many of them, and again, this can apply to both graduates and undergraduates, it can be the first experience of isolation from your, or distance from your usual support networks, be they spouses, close friends, family. First experience of, as well of doing everything yourself, making your own meals, managing your time, and so forth. They may also find themselves in the wrong discipline. All sorts of pressures might be on them to take this subject rather than that subject. So familial pressure, societal pressure may mean that they've ended up in a discipline they suddenly discover they have no affinity for, no liking for, and perhaps no immediate or no pressing desire to continue in. It may also be that they have an incomplete understanding of what the discipline entails. They take that first course. Oh, psych, I'd love to take psych. I'm really interested on what makes people tick. And then you find out you have to take stats. This may not be something that all people feel comfortable with entirely. So this may be an issue for some of them. It's their first experience of communal living for some of them. If they're in residence or in a graduate residence or an undergraduate residence, there's all that noise. There are all those temptations. There are opportunities for excess that one might not have had when living at home with the folks. And again, time management may make it difficult to find out when am I going to give time to excess and when am I going to give time to studies. We also know that, and this is, I'm talking here, thinking particularly here of undergraduate students, but it does manifest itself for the younger graduate students. So the ages of 18 to 24, typically, and we have a lot of research on the subject, where mental illness will manifest itself for the first time. So you will have students who've just arrived here, they're used to doing very well, they may be in a complete culture shock in part, and suddenly they're having symptoms that they've never experienced before. Something they can't explain, and they start trying to deal with it on their own, and with all the wrong ways. Substance abuse, denial, whatever. So that's another factor we as instructors need to be aware of. And of course they might have a previously diagnosed condition of some sort, proven coping strategies that worked fine when they were in Cégep or high school, but are proving themselves to be inadequate in this new context. And the additional stressor there is McGill's reputation. It's viewed by students, and they tell themselves this repetitively, and they exchange this information. It's very competitive. We're all trying to get into med school, for instance. Or it's brutal. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Every other student is a competitor. They're going to be hiding the books in the library. They'll be doing this, that, and the other thing. So these are stressors that add to the level of anxiety, and they may come with baggage, with personal problems or family problems, financial problems, unexpected ones. They may have visa problems. So all of these things will make it difficult for them to meet our expectations and to meet their own expectations of themselves. They'll have an impact on their academic performance as well as on their quality of life. And it'll be exacerbated when the student, which often happens, refuses or is unable to recognize that he or she may be in need of academic or other support. The manifestations of this are many. Academic results may be inferior to what the student expects or what the average in the class is. Or a student might be starting out working very well and suddenly there's the marks plummet. Or there's an uncharacteristic behavior of the student. Student will refuse to participate in group work or will do very poor individual work. The student may try to remedy the situation by having recourse to academic dishonesty. That last-minute paper you weren't able to get in on time, or you're afraid you're not going to be able to get in on time. Well, let's go check out what's on Wikipedia, and let's do a little cutting and pasting, see what happens. Fair play will help you discuss these issues with students. There's also a website called students/SRR, which will also connect you with more information on academic integrity. Requests for extension and supplemental work are another sign that things might not be going well. Disruptive behavior in the classroom and the lab are other signs. And there's also other worrisome behavior. And you will have in the material that was distributed to you an outline of what we call worrisome behavior and how we intervene in those cases. Very worrisome behavior we call the cops. Almost there, but not quite, we call security, and they'll do a little bit of triage. They'll make the call about whether we call the cops or not, or just send the student over to my office or accompany the student to my office or to mental health. Or if you just think something's a little off, a little uncharacteristic, you can certainly get in touch with my office, and we'll help you figure out what the next step might be. So part of your role is to be alert to these signs, to ensure that your students know about academic integrity and understand the consequences of violations of the code, and that it will not really be helpful in terms of their academic difficulty. Because if they get caught, they're going to get a bad mark. So trying to avoid getting a bad mark by plagiarism or cheating is really only deferring the problem. You may not discipline students yourself. Discipline is something that is in the hands of the disciplinary officer. You have the addresses. You can go to the disciplinary officer directory on the that letter you have about disruptive behavior. There's a link there. You can also link to it from my website. Disruptive behavior, you can, as an instructor, exclude a student from your classroom for the remainder of that class session and the following one. That gives you time to talk to the disciplinary officer and talk about appropriate follow-up behaviors and to see whether this needs investigation from a disciplinary perspective or from a mental health perspective or from other perspectives. The code says students cannot threaten. The code says students cannot disrupt teaching and learning activities. There are several articles to this effect, so you're protected on that way. What's a more positive way you can be with students is to mentor students. This commitment, the staff student mentoring program, means anybody who works at McGill can mentor an undergraduate student, and we ask for a minimum commitment of 2 hours per semester. So it's not a lot, but it gives students someone they know. If you're new at McGill, you can still mentor a student, believe me. If they haven't gone through the whole PhD process and the application for a job process, you still have a lot that you can tell them about. I hope you will get your own mentors as well. The resources are, and I'm almost done, this red folder, which tells you a little bit and gives you a bit more detail on the student service supports for students and the role of the Office of the Dean of Students in moments of crisis, student deaths, which do happen, student accidents, or what happens when there's a disruptive student in class. And on this side, they give you a sense of who you can go to talk to if you have a student whom you feel might have difficulty. We're always very protective, and with good reason, of our students' privacy and their being entitled to confidentiality. So the first thing we have to say to any student who comes to us with a problem is to say, you know, I will be respecting your confidentiality here. If you want me to talk about your problem to anyone else, I will do so only with your written consent. As I say, the Office of the Dean of Students is a resource as well. If you don't know what the next step is, just call us and we'll send you in the right direction. Your faculty student affairs offices are good resources, as are your departmental offices. The Ombudsperson for Student and Service Point as well, which is a good place to start for some type of registration question student might have. In other words, you don't have to be the specialists. You don't have to be the therapist. You don't have to be the person that helps them work through a problem. But you can connect them with the people who will do that. When in doubt, and it's not an emergency and you're not worried about your safety, give my office a call and we'll direct you, as I say, to the right person or service. Our time is up, so I don't think we have time for questions, but certainly I'll be here during the reception. Never miss a reception if I can help it. And I'll be happy to chat, and I promise to remain sober for the whole time. Great, setting a great example, Jane. So thank you for your non-questions, and I would like to now invite Dr. David Harp, McDonald Professor of Chemistry, to the podium.
Thank you, Dean Everett, and very pleased to be able to have a few remarks for you today. Mark Twain once observed that it was a terrible death to be talked to death, and I don't want to be the one to put you under. I'm going to hand that over to the last speaker of the day, our provost. There are two things that I would like to say before I talk about service or administration, as it might be said, as to how you can enhance that in your own book that you put in, because it is often a book for tenure at that particular time. One is something that I think I know I'm going to do, and I've done this for many years. Before your first class, don't go 5 minutes ahead. Go a day ahead to the room. Find out how you work the lights. Find out how you set up the computer if you're going to use a computer. If you don't have chalk, I have lots of chalk. I bought chalk years ago that now doesn't get used very much, but I have it. And you're welcome to any colored chalk, any kind you want, soft, hard, calcium sulfate, calcium carbonate chalk, it's all there. But seriously, go the day before or 2 days before, and that should be possible because you know where your class is going to be. And I suggest that there's almost nothing worse than a class of even 50, but if it's 200 looking at you, they're sizing you up, trust me. They want to know, who is this person? What are they all about? And you don't want to be down there fumbling with the computer, trying to get it booted up, looking up here, calling on the phone, which is all good. But check it out ahead of time. Put your whole lecture up there. The rooms are available. I don't think there are any rooms that are locked in this regard. The other thing that I would suggest before we get into, and this was brought up, fortunately, by the provost, by the question that was asked, find a mentor or two or three in your own, and I'll use the provost term, silo, because that's what we really have. We have the chemistry department, and one end we have the biochemistry department, a kilometer away. We don't tend to interact very much. That's not good, but that's the way it is. Your faculty is going to be one kind of silo, and then the departments within that faculty will all be a little bit different, and they will treat the notion of how you get promoted in a little bit of a different way each. And this is evident by a survey that we carried out with respect to the way by which merit is allocated. Some departments have a point system down to the tenth of a point, and it's 33%, 33%, 33% for each of the three pillars of your tenure, teaching, research, and service. Other faculties, like science, for whatever reason, it got set up as a 40-40-20, with service being the, the lesser of the three areas. I would suggest that service can be not only fun, but interesting, and you'll meet a lot of people that you'll never have had a chance to meet before if you participate to some extent. And what you don't want to do in year four is look at your service record and find that you've only had, let's say, four meetings of a curriculum committee, and that's about all you can put down, because that's not going to cut it, I'm quite sure, unless I see the provost nodding in some other direction. You have to have a respectable service record. Service can mean almost anything. It can be service to students. It can be service to the public. I'm thinking of one faculty of education member came here maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Her specific research was to investigate how students lie. Pretty interesting topic for all of the reasons that you can imagine in the legal confines of a courtroom for different kinds of unpleasant discussions. And it turned out that she was able, not even able, I don't know that she even put forward herself in this regard, but she's been on national TV in Canada, national TV in the United States, specials on ABC, where, because they want to know about this kind of thing. You may have a speciality that isn't quite as publicly enamoring as that one might be, but most likely you've got some public connected situation in your own research. Don't be shy to make it available to the press. Try to be accommodating if the press contacts you, because what they will do is look through the research areas that are evident on the websites that are all over the university If you're in psychology, for instance, they might want to find somebody who specializes in a certain kind of mental activity or so. They might call you. Take advantage of that. Write it down, as was said a few moments ago by Cynthia Weston. Write it down as an activity that you've carried out. Don't be shy. You don't want to put in too much detail. You can't make a major case out of yourself just by saying, well, I talked with somebody today at coffee. But you really need, if you're going to provide a respectable service record that really has some impact, what you really need to do is make sure that you make that impact by talking to any and all people who are relevant to your case. There is service that you can carry out with respect to the Alumni Association. We're having a homecoming in the middle of October, and you'll see all kinds of older folks, I guess you might say, older than you, and some maybe a little younger than you who come back, but it's mainly the people who come back who are coming back for their 20th or their 25th reunion. You can make a great impact if you have a talk or a lecture or a research area that you think the public might be interested in, an alumni association connections. You might be asked, they'll fly you to Boston to talk to the alumni people. If you've got something that you'd like to say, contact them. They're always looking for interesting people, younger people, particularly younger faculty, who can describe what they're doing in research and in their teaching as well. There are anything that deals with the outside of McGill is important to take a look at. And inside McGill, mentoring students, as was mentioned in the mentoring program by Dean Everett, this is where a student signs up to be, in effect, you are going to be their back for their time here at McGill. It isn't a lot of time that's being asked of you to do this. Those who have participated in this like it because the students, particularly those who come from a faculty different from your own, are going to get a connection in McGill that's going to be way better than if, not way better, but maybe a touch better than if they are just one more student in science or one more student in arts. Cross-pollination would be really the main idea here. You can get this by going to the website /mentoring and sign up. It's an easy thing to do. It takes really very little time overall. Any other element of dealing with your undergraduate students or even your graduate students by way of getting, let's say, research sessions or seminars that you initiate yourself that really aren't quite in the teaching arrangement, but they're really more in the service to the students to get your ideas across to them and just simply connect to them on a social kind of level. I'm not sure if there are any other connectivities that we could think of, but those are the main ones that I would suggest that you think carefully about doing in this regard. I think the major sum up that I would say, the alumni I wanted to mention I did, the major sum up in all of this, I think, is to find the right kind of people in your own department and in related departments that you are confident are have their egos under good management. There's nothing worse than an egomaniac who only wants for themselves. You can usually parse this out. Get three or four people. Talk to them about how it works in your own faculty and in your own department, because it will vary some, not dramatically, but it will vary some. There's no question. I think that's the main elements that I'd like to say. The last one to comment on is that you can meet an awful lot of people that you would never, if you just stay in your silo, to use that term, you can meet a lot of different people from the university, and it's surprising how varied they can be, as I'm sure you've found today by talking amongst yourselves. By joining the faculty club, that's obviously right here, and the McGill Association for University Teachers. Faculty Club have non-deductible dues, but they amount to about 13 cents a day. It's about $5 a month. It's exactly the best bargain on the North American or any other planet to belong to any kind of a club that would have you and I as a member. The MAUT fees are rather higher. On the other hand, there's about 1,000 people, a little over 1,000 actually, in each of these two groups. Many are, of course, in both. But those dues are deductible, and you will meet people that will be, I think, helpful for you and can give you some guidance overall. Now, I guess I'll stop at this point and ask other questions that I can perhaps deal with in some way. Sure.
You talked about mainly service within the university, yep. But I expect journal editorship and other things like that.
Yes, good point. I was thinking of which I had left out, and that's certainly one of them. This is kind of an overlap of research and service, but yes, that is one that comes up well placed in a dossier. If you are a journal editor or one of the reviewers, to indicate that if you've set up, for instance, a conference, this is a fantastic place to have a conference if there's not more than maybe 150 people. There are other venues in the university that you can have can host conferences. Many faculty do this. This is considered important as a service to the university and to your research community or your teaching community if you're interested in having or interested or you're in the education faculty and you are connected in that regard. As in research. That's a very good point. Yes?
Is it on? Yeah. Just as a follow-up, David mentioned that there's a certain fuzziness with some of those topics. When you come to putting your dossiers together, you have a choice to decide this activity was, I'm going to count it as research, or I'm going to count it as service, or I'm going to count it as teaching, or I'm going to count it as a service. But you can't take the same activity and put it into, you can't double count. So, you know, at some point when you're working on your dossiers, you need to think, where does it make more sense or which part needs more boosting? And if you're not sure, you know, talk to somebody, ask them, does this sound to you like service or does it sound like research? Where shall I put it? But don't double count.
No, that's a good point. Well taken. Any other? Yeah. Yes, I left that out too. I'm on so many committees that clouded my brain. Yes, I think that's certainly one of the areas. I'll give you an example in chemistry, for instance. One faculty member each year is selected to conduct advising for an entire group until they graduate. This is considered to be important kind of work. There's no question about that. Smaller committees, I mean, if you're on an open house committee, you know, what would you want to answer the question by putting yourself in the shoes of the tenure reviewer. Would you be impressed by that? And you'd say, I'm not very impressed, but I'm glad that they're active. Those are just a few things that you could do. But if you're on a serious committee that has multiple meetings, like a committee for changing the curriculum, this is absolutely a lot of work. Just being on it is a lot of work. Being chair of a curriculum committee within a department where you institute real heavyweight changes, this has to count. I would count this if I were sitting on a tenure committee as an important activity. Yes, absolutely, departmental committees. Anything that you do to help the university, serve the university, because it really comes back to you in all kinds of ways that I think it might surprise you. I think sometimes you may get advice that says, oh, service, yeah, well, put on a few things and just make sure your teaching and research are in good shape. Every faculty and department have slightly different attitudes about this. This a poor record in service or teaching would not cut it in chemistry, this I know. But you perhaps don't have to devote your entire life to all surface, but you really need to have an excellent-looking service dossier that shows that you're interested in the university and that the university and the outside is interested in you as well, if you possibly can do that. Yeah.
Are there sample dossiers that are available to?
Sample dossiers is the question to see what is considered to be top notch. Let's say reasonably good. I suspect any department or colleague who's recently been tenured, if you know them at least a little bit well, they'd be perfectly happy to say, here's the document, and to take a look at it and to say, well, why did you put this in and why did you put that in? That's why I'm trying to emphasize, I think one of the best things you can walk out of here with is the notion that you should try to find somebody that you trust. It may take a month or two before you really get to know them well enough to trust them. If you do, you can get an awful lot of very helpful information and good advice, and they'll give you just that kind of document.
Yes, we have sample teaching dossiers at TLS, and also some of them are online in almost every discipline. And what's interesting about a number of them is that they have included with it, while they don't have the research component and the service component included, they have a complete table of contents, so you can really see how somebody has structured their complete dossier.
There's another comment I might make, and I know this is depends on the size of class that you have, but I have some really, really very large classes, and I make myself feel guilty if I don't answer the email. Some profs just don't answer. If you talk to students, all you need to do is talk to maybe a second and third year student, three or four of each of those categories. And what you will hear is that half the profs that they have don't tend to answer many of their emails. They actually kind of expect it. Sometimes if you answer an email and you happen to be, I mean, it depends on whether you're addicted to your computer or not, but many of you may well be, you get an email that beams in, and it's a simple question. You can provide a quick, simple answer. You answer it, and it's back to them in, let's say, 30, 40 seconds. You're going to freak them right out of their socks, and they're going to love it. They're going to feel like you're the best thing that ever happened, and I don't know that that will get you a stalker or a follower. I don't believe that that will happen either. But students are very, very much more sensitive to what you do and say. I think back, and maybe the last little anecdote, because Provost needs to come and put the last nail in your coffin here today. This happened a long time ago, and there was a student, and you will find that this is true if you have a fairly good-sized class. You'll be walking across campus, and if you get that one extra second of eyeball contact, it's probably a student in your class. There's a sort of a cultural standard of how much you look at somebody in this way. And I remember there was one young man came walking across and caught my eye, and I figured he was in the class. So I says, "How you doing?" I think that's all I said. And it may not have been the same student, but I suspect it might have been. I got this report, and this is several hundred people in the class. Professor Harp knows the names of every single student in this course. You can make a very big impact with students if you just are a little bit friendly. Smile, say hello, and I'll give you maybe the last of the last was that there was a young woman who came down to ask questions at the end of the organic chemistry class a couple of times. And I thought she was not from Canada, but I was making a guess. And I was looking through the pictures of the students, which you will get, the images of their face. Not very good pictures, but anyway, she was very recognizable. She came down, I remember her name was Irina, and the class was buzzing and boiling around, ready to start, and she came down to ask some simple question. I think it was maybe the third time, and I says, "Oh, hi, Irina, how are you?" And you would have thought I had shot her or punched her. She kind of went back like that, and she said, "How did you know my name?" And this was my only inspired moment of the semester. I said, "I know all their names." And then she looks at me like, so she got it. But the fact is that I have talked to her probably six or eight times over the last year since she left the class. It's the only class I had her in. And she even from Romania brought me a jar of jam from her grandmother, which I absolutely accepted. But these things will happen if you're just that touch. Well, it was after the grades, long after the grades, years, decades after the grades. Yeah, no, that's quite true. You want to be careful about accepting gifts prior to grades, but afterwards may happen, and so what? If I've answered some things, I hope I have, and I will ask the provost to, I'll give the hammer is up here and the nail is here, and he can do the last bits. Thank you.
It's David Harp is a true citizen of McGill, and I think it's important he didn't emphasize some of the other things that he's involved in. I think the pitch for the faculty club is that he's on the council of the president of the faculty club, but we'll allow a bit of that. But it is important. This is a nice structure. It's an important structure in the life of the university. It's something that deserves our support when we can give it, and it is not that expensive to be a member, although you still have to pay for your own meals, right? It's not so you have to do that. But there are other ways of participating in the life of the university that are part of the service component, and I think David was pointing them out. Someone asked a question earlier about focus groups, or it was given as an answer, focus groups on the new learning management system. That is going to be something that takes some time and makes a contribution. So it would be one of those things that goes into Cynthia's virtual shoebox, but on the services side. As Lydia pointed out, you have to understand that building a dossier means that you count things in the appropriate boxes, but you can't split them. So that kind of service might be service or it might be teaching. Depends on how you think of that particular activity and where you want it to count. The university has many committees at the departmental level, at the faculty level, at the university level. Those are all service to the community. If you're elected, you can also be a member of the Senate, or even if you're not elected, you can serve on Senate committees. So there are committees that are available for in allowing the collegial life of the university and its collegial governance and administration to continue. Those are the kinds of internal contributions that you can make. They don't always have to be formal, because a focus group won't have a formal recognition anywhere, but your participation on it and attestation that you were there can count as service to the university. External service was asked. It's a great question, because you will serve on committees in your profession. You may be asked to set up a conference, to lead a conference group, to organize a poster session that's not part of your own research. Those can be service to the community, broadly understood. So, and to the intellectual and academic and university community. There are also activities that can link you more directly into having an impact in the community in which the university is located. That's right. I was going out and talking in the community to high schools, to CGEPs, to other groups of interest. University Women's Club comes to mind as one, because my wife is a member. But, so you have all of these other opportunities to be integrated into the community. The focus of today was to help you get oriented to what our expectations are, what we think the university is getting when we accepted you as faculty members here. And as the principal said, we're extremely pleased that you accepted that offer. We're proud of the quality of the people who have come into McGill in the last decade, and even those of us who have been here longer. We have some sense of pride in what McGill has been able to accomplish, but the academic renewal that's brought so many new professors to McGill is built on your credentials, your research, your contributions to teaching, and your service to the community. So we really thank you for allowing us the opportunity to build a career with you and to see this come to fruition, hopefully with promotion and tenure. So the official part of the program is over, and I am standing between you and a glass of wine. So I would, however, like to give you the opportunity to ask any closing questions for the day. And remember, there will be other orientation sessions for applying for grants, as Rosie Goldstein said. Stay connected to teaching and learning services. Get involved in the community. Be part of your faculty and your department from day one. But don't only stay in that silo. Take the principal up on her offer. Get to know someone who's not in your own department or program or even faculty, and expand your horizons about, well, this wonderful university in this great city. So thanks for your participation, but I will take questions if you have any. Or we can do it over wine.